I had not trained for this marathon. The furthest I had run was 13 miles prior to running this marathon, and I only decided to do it 2 weeks ago. And the reason I did it was to see if being mentally tough and mental toughness could overcompensate for not being physically in at peak performance.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 13 of our Building Better Leaders podcast. This week we've got something a little bit different for you. We're going to be talking about mental toughness, and we're going to be asking Rachel a few questions about the marathon that she ran on Sunday and how this works, how mental toughness works in leadership. So ordinarily we would have had the leadership essentials at the front, but we're going to put them to the end of the actual podcast. So Rachel, how are the legs feeling this morning? It's a couple of days since you ran the marathon on Sunday, and it's always that day after the day after.
Yes, it is. My body, I'm in so much pain. There's actually no words for how much pain one's toes can cause you. Like, I'm losing a toenail, my back's hurting, my legs are hurting, but you know what, I'm feeling really good. I really enjoyed it. So for those of you that don't know, last weekend, Sunday the 4th of October, was the 40th London Marathon. And due to COVID-19 and the year that 2020 has been, unfortunately, the marathon that's normally in April was deferred to October, but it still couldn't be done with social distancing needs to be done. So instead, the elites ran it, and I was watching that after I'd run my marathon, which we will talk about later. But everybody else that had entered the London Marathon could run it virtually anywhere around their hometown. Now, this might surprise you when we're talking about mental toughness, is I actually hadn't entered the London Marathon. I chose to do it to support my friend Sarah. Hi, Sarah, if you're listening. And Sarah was running the London Marathon to raise money for Scope, the children's charity, because her nephew was born at 29 weeks and suffered two bleeds on the brain when he was born, and is subsequently, he can't walk and he can't talk. He's 5 years old and in a wheelchair. So Sazzy runs a lot of runs to raise money for Scope, because they do awesome work for kids like Stanley. So what does mental toughness have to do with running, and what does mental toughness have to do with leadership? So bear with us. I'm going to kind of tell the story of mental toughness and how we can relate it to leadership through my experience of experiencing mental toughness and applying that in running a marathon. So really, running for me is a way that I kind of manage my anxiety. If you were to ask my husband if I'm an anxious person, he would say off the scale. I am constantly living in the future, always planning, always wanting the next thing. And running is a way that really kind of keeps me present and kind of arranges thoughts in my head and calms me down. And this year has been quite an up and down year, hasn't it, John? And running is something that I used to do a lot. I have run a couple of marathons before. It's something that I used to do a lot in Australia. And my son is 2 now, so I kind of didn't. I ran a lot when I was pregnant, but I didn't. Well, I don't think anybody runs like the 6 months after they've had a baby, because that would be painful. So I got into run. I got back into running when lockdown started. Started putting a lot of K's in the legs to kind of help me through being on furlough, help me through getting made redundant from work, helping me kind of think about what we were going to do with the business, John. And, you know, obviously the idea for the podcast came out of a long run. Go figure. So basically, I hadn't entered the London Marathon, and then Sazzy asked me if I would run half of the London Marathon with her to support her, and she asked me this about a month ago. I said, yeah, of course I will, no problem. I mean, for me, on a Sunday, I will typically run 10 miles anyway. Never really run any further than that, but I'll do a few 5Ks and then a 10 miler on a weekend. So I was like, yeah, no problem. And then 2 weeks ago, she was like, look, are you really on for this? I'm doing the course. I said, oh, go on. I'll do 16 miles with you. And then I went, you know what, if I'm running 16, I may as well try and do the whole thing with you. So this is where mental toughness comes into play, because I had not trained for this marathon. The furthest I had run was 13 miles prior to running this marathon, and I only decided to do it 2 weeks ago. And the reason I did it was to see if being mentally tough and mental toughness could overcompensate for not being physically in, like, at peak performance, I guess. Does that make sense, John?
Yeah, absolutely. So you hadn't actually put in all the training that you would have ordinarily put in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet you had a sort of a twofold reason for doing it.
Yeah, I think if you were to ask me why I did it, I'd love to be selfless enough to say I 100% did it to support my friend Saz. And if I'm brutally honest, that is why I would have run 16 miles with her, like, to support her. I would have done that for anyone. But would I have run 26 miles just to support somebody? No, I wouldn't.
And I know everybody that Rachel has actually had that conversation with a friend.
Oh, yes, yeah, so, yeah.
So she's not sitting there now thinking, I can't believe that she wasn't really doing it for me.
No, yeah. Literally, I was going to run 16 miles to support her, and I did run and pace her to support her. But what made me want to run the full thing was this, I guess, inquisitiveness and curiosity about how strong my mind and my head actually could be at a time where things are massively uncertain. Where, you know, we're coaches, John, we do a lot of work on ourselves in terms of personal development, but we're not fallible, we're unfallible, we're not immune to this stuff. I have to do a lot of work on myself to keep myself in a positive place. And it has been a very difficult year. There's always a niggling thing in the back of my mind that things can always get worse. And I kind of wanted to, I did this to prove to myself almost that this year hadn't just gone as nothing, and that there was a big achievement for it, and that I could do it. And therein, I guess, some people might think I'm crazy for just wanting to do it to see if I could. What I do want to absolutely fundamentally stress is I would never advocate to anybody that they run a marathon having never trained or only deciding to run a marathon 2 weeks before. What I do want to make very, very clear is I'd run 3 marathons prior to this, obviously before I'd had my son, but I had some muscle memory, I guess, and I also had an understanding of running 3 before, of where the dark places that my mind and body would go. And I also knew my own limitations. So I also went into this going, if it hurts or you feel like you're going to injure yourself, you must stop. I would never recommend to somebody that had never run a marathon before that you would.
It is important that you say that, because... But anybody who has actually run a marathon will know that they'll never, ever forget the experience. I've only done a couple of half marathons, but to think at the end of that half marathon, I've got to go and do it all again, it's like very challenging. But so you never forget that.
No. So yeah, when we were thinking about doing a podcast on mental toughness, what I really thought was I need to put myself in a place where you're really living and breathing mental toughness to be able to relate it to leadership in the sense. Because this word mental toughness, it's blanded about a lot in sport. You know, to be an athlete at the top of your game, you have to be really mentally tough. And it is a bit of a buzzword. It has been for the last, I'd say, 5 years in L&D circles and personal development circles. And mental toughness and grit are kind of used interchangeably. And they are used in the boardroom, I think, and they are used at a leadership level. But I think they're used in conversation without clear understanding of what they are. So I think it might just be quite...
In conversation, in terms of sport.
No, in terms of leadership.
Yeah, because I think the difference with sport is that you get immediate feedback from being mentally tough or not being mentally tough. It's whether you see teams performing to the highest level, you get that feedback within the period of the game or the length of the race. Whereas in the boardroom, things take a lot longer to get that feedback. You don't get the financial results straight away.
So when we look at the definition of mental toughness, I think it's quite useful for us in this context to look at it in a sporting context and then to look at mental toughness as a more broader term. So in sport, mental toughness is defined as having the natural or developed psychological edge that enables you to generally cope better than your opponent with the many demands that sports place on the performer. So that's to be more consistent and better than your opponents in remaining determined, focused, confident, and in control under pressure. And that's the definition by Jones, Hanton, and Connaught from 2002. Now, when you look at that definition, if we were actually to interchange sport to business and performer to leader, it kind of works. But I think the thing about being mentally tough in sport is it's that unwavering determination and focus on that one goal, be it running a marathon or 100 metres like Usain Bolt. It's shorter. Whereas I think when you look at mental toughness in leadership, well, you can't be as focused on one thing in mental toughness in leadership.
No, because you're going to be pulled across all different kinds of situations, aren't you, in your day?
Exactly. But there is a lot about the mental toughness that an athlete needs to have to be, and we're talking about absolute peak performance, and what a leader needs to have. And interestingly, there is a psychometric study of how mentally tough you are, which is the MTQ48. You do have to, if you are interested in taking a study on how mentally tough you are, you do it over a period of weeks and months, and you need to go to somebody who's accredited to run the psychometric tool on you. But it is worth doing if you want to be at the very top in leadership, because there are a multitude of studies that prove that people that are more mentally tough climb higher up the corporate ladder. And it's not that the opposite of mental toughness is weakness. It's not. It's actually that the opposite of that is perhaps being a little bit more sensitive.
Yeah.
So it's not about weakness. It's about sensitivity. But actually, people that are more mentally tough have a higher incidence of climbing up to the CEO level. So when we look at mental toughness, I guess the professor that's most aligned with this definition is Professor Peter Clough. And he came up with a 4 C's model of what mental toughness requires. And that is, you know, control over your life and your emotions, commitment, so how committed you are to achieving your goal, and that you are willing to put in the practice to the process for it, a confidence in your abilities. And that includes, you know, a confidence in yourself, like personally, but also a confidence in your ability to influence others, and that real kind of understanding that you can surround yourself with the right people that are going to give you that positive affirmations that you need in. And the last C is challenge. So really about, you know, have you got risk taking? Are you willing to push yourself? Are you driven to succeed? And can you learn from your past experiences, and that you have this mental predisposition to see setbacks as a form of learning?
So that's control, commitment,
confidence. And challenge. You foresee.
So how, if we were thinking about you, we go back to Sunday on the start of the run. Talk to me about control. How did you use that in the context of the actual run, Rach?
So that's, I'll tell you, my pre-running training, if you like. So basically, I kind of applied this model and the definition of grit as well, which is your passion and persistence put together. So people that are gritty individuals, and you can tell it in kids, actually. There's just some kids that won't give up. It's like steadfastness. Grit, steadfastness are also very aligned with mental toughness. You might score slightly different on them, but you don't tend to get one without the other. So I like to think of myself as a quite gritty individual. I don't give up. If somebody tells me that I can't do it, I'm just like...
Well, that almost gives you more...
Whatevs, yeah.
...emphasis to want to do it, yeah.
So on this control, so I kind of looked at this model and I thought, right, 2 weeks to go. The longest one I have done is 13 miles, and I did that exactly 2 weeks before the marathon.
Yeah.
So I was like, right, I've got to run that all over again. So I can't put any more Ks in my legs. I cannot put any more miles in my legs because rest is more important than experience that close up to a marathon. So I was like, what can I control? Well, I can control my head. And I have to really believe that I can do this. So being a, having, you know, master's in coaching psychology and being a coach and being around a lot of people that study peak performance, I thought, well, what can I do? So really believing that I can do it, I used a psychological tool called PETLEP. Have you heard of PETLEP, John?
I haven't.
Oh, you love this one.
I'm looking forward to it.
PETLEP is a visualization tool, and a lot of golfers at the top end of their game use PETLEP, and I guess strikers.
Oh, that's why I'm playing off 13 then still.
So PETLEP is a visualization exercise where they use it a lot in sports where, you know, if you really wanted to perfect, say, scoring a goal in football, you could physically do that, you know, do that action and aim for the net. Like what, 100 times?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you'd do it 100 times in a couple of minutes, in 5 minutes. But you're going to get to a certain point where the body's going to fatigue and then your performance isn't going to get as good. And so there's only so many hours you can physically train. But what psychologists have uncovered is actually if you wear exactly the same outfit as what you were going to wear, and you're in the field, stood in the field doing it, or you're looking at the net, but you just close your eyes and visualize, your brain fires the exact same neurons than if your body physically kicked the ball. So you have to really, really believe that you are doing it. But yeah, a lot of athletes do this so they don't risk injury. But if you practice PETLEP well enough, your visualization becomes so good, you actually, your brain plasticity becomes so much so that it's like you're physically doing the exercise.
So what does the mnemonic PETLEP actually stand for then, Rachel?
So the PETLEP is an acronym that stands for the seven elements that you need to do to be able to imagine something as such that it's like you're doing it physically. So the P is physical. So if we use the football acronym, the image would require the footballer to be in their kit while they're imagining it. So when I was imagining myself running the marathon, I was in my running stuff. Environment is, if possible, you need to be able to imagine the environment that the performance takes place. So have you actually been into the stadium? Have you actually walked your course? So Sarah and I cycled the course before we did it. So you can imagine yourself being there.
Yeah,
you know, people use PETLEP as well when they're doing public speaking. If you can go to the place where you're public speaking and physically remember and imagine yourself there, PETLEP works better.
Yeah, you get a lot of football teams now that because they're playing at completely different times through the weekend, they may have a lunchtime kickoff, they might have an evening kickoff, that they'll actually do their training session at the same time the day before.
Yeah. So
it's just that replicating that environment.
T stands for task. So that's trying to imagine the details relevant to the task. So, you know, you can't visualize yourself being better than you probably are. Do you know what I mean? You have to be, a lot of people visualize themselves like, singing for the X Factor. But
have you been thinking about this, you know, just like during your normal day?
Yeah.
Thinking about how the actual sort of just the action of your run.
Yeah, totally. And I'm not, when I've been visualizing myself, because I've been doing it as PETLEP, I'm not visualizing myself running with Elliot Kipchoge running a sub 2 hour marathon. Do you know what I mean? I'm visualizing myself at a reasonable time, which is about the 4 hour mark.
Yes. Yeah.
But you're visualizing yourself in the moment. So the task, you know, it has to be, if you're an elite player, you're visualizing yourself at something you've already done, that level. Do you get me? Yeah. Then the other T, so there's two T's in PETLEP. The other T is timing. So the most functionally equivalent approach is to imagine it in real time. So don't imagine, you know, when you imagine striking a football or doing a presentation or for me running the marathon. It was just to imagine me running 5 minutes of it, but in real time, not imagine me. It's sped up.
Right. So you don't want to be just sort of seeing yourself start off and then
no.
almost be crossing the line within it. Those two things don't want to be together.
Yeah. And even like, say, if you were a golfer, you would be imagining the golf swing in real time. It wouldn't just be whoosh, it's done.
Yeah.
It would be feeling the club and you're really imagining it as long as it would take. Yeah. L is for the learning, so the imagery should be continually adapted and reviewed to match your changing demands.
So when you're going through the first part of the PET, if you like,
yeah,
the learning part is reviewing that.
Yeah, and then keeping updating it.
And updating it.
To learning it as you're reviewing it, and have you got better? Like, for me, when I'm running and I get really tired, my arms come up too close and then my shoulders start to crunch up.
So you become aware of that.
So I will visualise myself doing that, because I'll get the feeling of how stressed out I get in a run, before a run, and then I have to kind of swing my arms down lower, and you'll visualise that and incorporate that into the learning. E is for the emotion. So you almost want to imagine the same emotions that you would feel. So those little butterflies or that kind of sickness feeling. You want to imagine the crowd if you're an elite performer.
So tell the story then about...
And then the final... Just let me finish this one, then I'll come on to that. And then the final P in PetLep is the imagery perspective. So it has to be through first person. You can't imagine yourself looking at yourself. Do you know what I mean? You need to be fully... So what the thing that about PetLep...
You are in your body.
Yeah, the thing that about PetLep that's such a useful imaginary tool, and it's really useful in leadership as well, is it's such an immersive imaginary thing that all your neurons in your brain are firing, that you are imagining yourself doing it in the real time, with the real emotion, in the real public space. So whether it be you're a leader giving a talk to everybody, but you are imagining it as you in the first person. So when you come to do the actual event, your brain is already used to the fact that you've done it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's almost like practicing without risking the injury. Back to the model of mental toughness in that control, I use PetLep the 2 weeks before to, as best I could, to imagine myself running
race. How much time did you actually spend doing that in the weeks before, do you think?
I'd spend like probably 15 minutes every day because I didn't have heaps of time, but I really did control the fact that I believed I could. Now, this is where obviously the fact that I'd run 3 marathons before really helped me, because a few people were like, "You're mad, what are you doing that for? You'll not get down, you'll not get round." I mean, I'm from Yorkshire. Like, more people told me I couldn't do this than told me that I could.
But what they're doing in many respects, or how you use that, is to motivate you even more to achieve.
Totally. But also in my head, I was like, I had a kid two years ago, and it was a brutal labour of like 12 hours and it still ended up in a cesarean, and I'm like, nothing could be worse than that pain. There is no place that I could put myself in running that would be as painful as that experience. So again, I was using my past experience to control what I could. And I guess the other thing for me was I did a lot of work on like my meditation and my mental strength. So I've got the Calm app. If you haven't got it, get on it. If you listen to Rich Roll's podcast, I think he's got a 50% discount code for it. So I'd really, really recommend the Calm app. I started doing meditation every day just to be able to remind myself that I am not my emotions, that I am having an emotion and I can detach from an emotion. And just like you can compartmentalize pain, you can compartmentalize emotions. So I got back into meditation. That again is something I've not done for a few years. I know all the skills for it and the tools. I mean, at one point I think I meditated every day for 2 years, but that was like years ago. So I revisited meditation. I also started listening to on the Calm app an exercise in mental strength with LeBron James, the basketball player, around how he prepares, and that he prepares just as much for his mind as he does for his, like, physical...
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I don't know anybody who listens to as many podcasts as you do and all these self-help tools. And so I think it's probably fair to say right now is that we will reference all these for you in the show notes. Because we are sort of throwing a lot at you, but really, really interesting stuff. So that's the sort of control.
Yeah, and I think just on the podcast thing, I mean, I've massively listened to so many podcasts the last 2 weeks. And it's not just because obviously I love all this stuff. It's if you haven't got the positive people around you, you've got to control it yourself, what you're putting into your ears and into your mind. Like Rich Roll, LeBron James, all those kind of people these last 2 weeks, because I needed to hear that I could do it. That makes sense. That
absolutely makes sense. I totally understand that. And it is just reinforcing messages because your brain's not bothered about what you tell it.
No.
Positive or negative, it doesn't really it doesn't decide, but it does react to whether it is positive or negative.
Totally. And so I was really conscious of that. I was really conscious of my mindfulness, which is really that control as well, having control of my emotions. I guess from my commitment, my goal setting is there was not one bit of me that started out that run thinking I was going to run 26 miles. In my head, I was running 10 miles. And then
so this is
10K,
about breaking it down into manageable chunks.
Yeah. I was like, I'm going to run 10 miles. That's just my normal Sunday morning run. And then very quickly in the race, I was like, actually, no, I'm going to change this to running 4 10Ks. And that worked well for me. So I even adapted in the run once I got into it. But all I started off with was, I'm going to 10 mile, Sunday morning, 10 mile run. And then I've got to do another 10 mile and 2 threes. But on the course, on the day, I just kind of adapted it to Ks. That just kind of reminded me, I think, of the marathons that I'd run before.
And had you always used that breakdown before? Or have you played around with that formula?
Yeah, even in the half marathons and the, I think I'd run a 16K. I never go out to run 16K. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a couple of fives and see how I feel. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's, again, in leadership, it's breaking it down. If you've got something that's too big to
do. You have a huge project.
Your team can't get their heads around that huge project. You know, you've got to, and at the end when it really hurt, me and Saz were just like, this is just two, three miles. That's just two runs with the dog.
So you've done your first 10K. When you've done your first 10K, you've got some feedback for that and some you can give yourself some recognition for having reached that milestone. So if you think about it in terms of a project, same thing. You know, we're going to achieve these sort of smaller steps and then when we've done it, we can have a bit of a celebration and say
totally.
That we've got there and then...
You just go, let's regroup. So in the race at 10K, I'm like, looking at my time, am I on target to do sub 4, which I was at that time, which in leadership, you don't rest and do that. You keep going, but where are we against time? Where are we against resource? But what can we learn? Do we need to speed up? Do we need to slow down? How are we feeling? This is where your mindfulness and your control comes in. Check in. How's the body? How are the people? How are the team? And I just don't know if we do that enough.
No. So that's commitment. Is there anything else you want to say about commitment?
Not really. I mean, the other thing about commitment is really that having that grit, knowing that you won't give up, and it never ends. I think you've really just got to have it in your mind that there's no option of giving up. I think on Saturday, the day before the run, I allowed myself. Well, I didn't control my mind enough. That I had a bit of a wobble, that I might not be able to do it. It lasted about 3 minutes and I had to quash it. I think it was that 2 days before, I had a bit of a cough, which in COVID times I was oh goodness. And I got COVID like 2 days before I'm running a marathon. I didn't. It was just I had a bit of a sore throat that was making me cough. So I wasn't feeling my best. So I think it was, you have to be at such that your mind and your body are the same as the tasks that you need to do. And again, bringing this back to leadership with mental toughness, you know, it's not about being preachy here, but it's about really getting people aware of how fit is your mind and how fit is your body for leadership? And you can't be all mental toughness if you're still sinking a bottle of wine a night and you're tired and you're not sleeping properly. And it's really about mental toughness is about being alert, having your brain in the best condition that it is. So really, actually, you know, I allowed myself that little wobble because my body didn't feel right. So I think that was actually a good thing about being aware to it. But that's actually has prompted me to one thing that what I was super committed to the week before this run, obviously 10 days before, not a drop of alcohol passed my lips. I slept like Gareth was laughing his head off. He's like, oh, we're going to bed early, getting all excited. I was like, babe, I'm going to sleep you so hard tonight. And he's like, oh. I was just like, I was like 10 hours a night. So, like, I was in bed at 8 o'clock, not getting up till 7, like clearly not sleeping the entire time, but just resting. And I literally, my commitment to sleep that 2 weeks before
was solid.
Was absolutely yeah. solid. Because I knew I couldn't, no booze. I don't eat meat anyway. So my diet and my nutrition were spot on. Again, been back to, you know, your gut is a brain. Mm. What you put in your stomach will have a massive impact on your mental toughness and your mental alertness. So I just really, really looked after my body. And in the absence of putting in the time in the legs, I just did what I could that was best for my body. And I think, you know, when you think, I think that's this about big projects that I've worked on and things where perhaps like the stress has really been on, how often, and I'm thinking back now, could I have been in a better place if I'd have actually, you know, the nights where I was in the office till 10 o'clock at night, still expecting a better result to come. And actually all I needed to do was go home and sleep to probably be able to think through a problem better. How often yeah. did it get to 7 o'clock and you're still at work, but you're grabbing a beer?
Yeah, it happens so much, doesn't it? You know, you get to seven and you are really actually exhausted and your brain's not a very efficient piece of kit.
No.
You know, it needs rest, it needs food. And you know, how many times do you come back into the office the next day or into your room wherever you're working now and you pick up from where you left off the night before and in like half an hour you've done it.
Seconds it comes. I think we, you know,
we don't do it enough, do we?
I
really
think what I love most about the psychology and particularly how athletes have impacted the boardroom in the last few years is this notion of, you know, when people like think back to your days in banking, and I'm thinking particularly 10 to 5 years ago where people would come in and wear it like a badge of honour, like, oh, I only need 5 hours of sleep a night. Oh, I only operate on 4. I used to work for a CMO. I only need 4 hours of sleep. And it was like worn like a badge of honour.
Yeah.
That's not famous. Like, that no. doesn't get you anywhere now. If I see somebody that brags that they don't sleep much, I think you're not to be trusted because I don't trust your thought process. You're going to make more risky decisions because your brain isn't rested.
You can't possibly make your body do something that it's not capable of doing. You can push it, you can challenge it, and you can give it all that proper affirmation that you were talking about earlier on. But eventually,
your body needs
your
rest.
Your body needs rest. And,
absolutely. And, you know, listen to the LeBron James series on your mental state of mind, on calm. I mean, he is an athlete at the top of his game and he sleeps for 10 hours every single day. And he's like, I do not like let anybody take that away from me. He has a 2-hour nap every single day and he plans his whole life around his sleep. Now, obviously, as an athlete, you need to do that because you need more rest. But actually, as a leader, I think you need to get really fierce over protecting your sleep and knowing that when things are going to get tough, you need more sleep than less. But that's counterintuitive because work needs you for more time than less. So it's how you balance that. But I think back to this thing where these words like grit and mental toughness, they do get blanded around a lot and people don't know what they mean. And we know all this stuff, but we don't put it into practice. And honestly, through this marathon training and running it, I have felt the best I have ever felt through all this lockdown and COVID. And, you know, anxiety's gone up and down and things like that. But I haven't looked after myself as well as what I looked after myself in that 2 weeks prior to that marathon. And I wanted to see how well I could feel. And you know, now my body is broken. But I feel wonderful in my head. You know, I feel this amazing sense of achievement. But actually, that's not even just the fact that I've done it. It's the fact that I've been resting. I've been meditating. I've learned new things.
Yeah, it was because I when you were talking and saying that and saying how well you felt about it, that was the thing that I was sort of referencing in my head was it, how much of that good feeling, if you like, comes from the achievement of actually doing the race, but. I'm sort of countering that, but now I'm thinking that quite a lot of the achievement includes the preparation for the race and how you got yourself into the right mentality, the right having the right amount of sleep, having the right amount of the right diet. When you put it all together, that's the achievement, isn't it? It's not just the race.
Yeah,
the race became more manageable, if you like, because you did all the right things at the beginning.
Totally. And I love that you brought that up because I think that absolutely brings to life what mental toughness means. Because if mental toughness means if you don't do the race or you don't finish or things go wrong or you lose, you fall to pieces because it didn't go your way, you're not mentally tough. Remember that last thing about the definition of mental toughness is your ability to learn. And so when you actually think about it, you know, for those of you that watched the race on Sunday, the actual marathon, Eliud Kipchoge, who was by far the favourite, I mean, talk about just a wonderful, purpose-driven, positive, mentally tough individual. It just wasn't for him. It wasn't his race. He had the paces. Everything looked okay for the first bit, but the weather didn't go in his favour. But he didn't throw the towel in. At the end, he still finishes the race. He came in way behind where he was expected. I mean, not to take the achievement away from Katata because he was fabulous and it was great to see Ethiopia win. But it was the fact that he still made time to congratulate everybody. He'll just be coming straight back to it with a, what can I learn? You know, this is a man that tried to break the 2-hour record, missed it by 20 odd seconds, and then 2 years later came back to do it. You know, that's a mentally tough individual that you can fail at something and then train for another 2 years to have another go at it. So I think back to this thing around mental toughness, I reflected a lot for doing this marathon and how I've changed as a person over the last probably 4 or 5 years. Now, in my early 30s, the idea of doing a marathon where you weren't going to get any external praise or gratification or a medal for it, I would have been like, what's the point? Do you know what I mean? I wanted to see my name on that website with a good phrase. When I did the Sydney Marathon, I came like 33rd, like in the, you know, that really like meant something for me that I was like on the board. This year I hadn't even entered, so I wasn't going to get an official time. There was no ego in that. There was no big crowds. I was doing it in part in service. And I think that's quite nice. You know, I wouldn't have run the full thing. I suppose I needed another, I needed another purpose for me to do it. But I did pace my friend. I ran ahead of her to like, you know, set her pace. I did it because I wanted to do something good. I wanted to give something back to somebody that's been a really good friend for me all year. And I didn't hit this in my head. I kind of set off going, I want to do sub-4. But when I kind of realised that wasn't, it was only the last 10K I realised I hadn't trained enough. But I was like, okay, that's fine. Go to sub 4:10. That's fine. You know, it was like, this is still an achievement to just do it.
I think that's what I'm picking up here is that he's like, how wide is achievement in its spectrum? You know, if you're in top level elite sport, then, you know, winning is pretty key. But I think there is achievement across a much wider spectrum, isn't there?
I think this is why a lot of people, as they get older, like long distance running. And the beauty of marathon running is it's something that actually you excel at the older you are, to a cut-off point, obviously. But it's a sport, and like fell running and trail running, you get better at it in your 30s and 40s, and you don't see many people winning in their 20s because they're not mentally as tough. And I think it's the same with leadership. You know, in my early like days as a leader, the getting the promotion mattered the most. You know, that was your, to put it into the athletes thing, it was just getting the promotion, getting to a head off, getting to this. But I think the higher and higher you get, or as you become a leader at a board level, well, actually, there might be a little bit of ego about it being a bigger and bigger company. But most people tend to move sideways at that level. And it just becomes about a new challenge for you, or a different kind of purpose, or working for a company that's more purpose driven, or that aligns something to your dreams and aspirations when you were younger. And I think that's the definition really of a mentally tough person, is that they're intrinsically motivated. So it's more of an internal motivation, because it's something you want to do deep down, rather than the fact that your wife, your cousin, you can brag about it to your boys,
yeah,
club,
you
want to
be
girls.
The best in, yeah, in the office or whatever,
yeah, yeah, and yeah, there's, yeah, a lot of that, yeah. You know, there's so many leaders that you meet that they love the braggability of their job, or the status, or the door open that comes with it, and fair play if that's what motivates you. But there's an age or a level or of experience or a life event that will change you out of that mentality. So I guess that's the commitment bit of the mental tough. The next one, I guess, was confidence. And how, now you have to, the thing with confidence is you have to have confidence in your abilities. Now, I've mentioned before, I'd done 3 marathons before, so I knew I could do it. And also, I knew I could do half a marathon. Now, I know...
Did you not have a little bit of doubt, though? Because those marathons that you'd done before...
Oh, they were
done before you had...
8 years ago. I did, but I think this is where I, on reflection, I have been working on my mental toughness for a long time, probably all my 30s. You know, I've had significant life events, like I think I've talked about before, like my mum died when I was 17. My brother struggles with mental health issues and addiction. And late last year, my brother-in-law took his own life. So I've had a fair few knocks, shall we say, over the years. And you always revisit this thing around your mental strength and what are you going to do with it. So the thought, I know a lot of people will be going, well, you ran half a marathon and you think, oh, well, I've only got to do that again. For most people, they run half a marathon and go, I could never do that again. For me, I was like, well, I've only got to do that again. My reflection on running half a marathon again wasn't the same. And again, I use that goal setting thing where I play with percentages a lot. So I play with that, like, oh, I'm 25% through a run, I'm 50% through a run. And then there's something in your brain that's like, oh, as soon as we passed halfway, I was like, right, only 49% left. So I'd kind of used a bit of that reverse psychology on me. So my confidence actually didn't waver. And the interpersonal confidence of the model of mental toughness is being able to influence others. Now, my friend Sarah, who ran the marathon with me, would she have broken her PB if I hadn't run with her? Yes, 100%. She was in a much better mental place because we did the training together and the mental toughness preparation together. But if I hadn't have run it with her, I don't think she would have got as good time as what she did. Like, she smashed her PB by like 27 minutes. It was amazing. But that was, I guess, an example of me being able to influence her. Our other friend Jamie, we run with a lot. And he comes onto one of my leadership essentials later. He ran the last 10 miles with us. But he was like, oh no, I won't be able to do this. You know, he's a bit more on that negative kind of thing. And I was like, no, I can stand my ground. I was like, I'm mentally strong enough to be able to do this. Jamie's physically more fit than me, but my head's stronger. And I knew that. Do you know what I mean? I was like, and that's for me to take ownership of, really. I think I talked about this before, when my mum brought me up to always be like, you can do it. Now, you've got to be really careful with that kind of mentality, because sometimes you think you can do something you can't. And again, I can't stress enough, just steadfastness will not get you through something if your body's
not up
for it. It's
not everything, but it's very, very important.
And you know, you often see a lot of leaders. I've worked for one leader in particular, actually, that I reflect back on, that just thought he could do something and he thought it was good enough, and he wasn't 100% not for it, and he had a massive career fail. And yeah, I think he's picked himself up now. But I think bloody hell, talk about being promoted too early, and that, you know, just believing you can isn't always it, is it? And then the last one in the model, in Clough's model, is challenge. And that is about risk-taking and being driven to succeed and pushing yourself. And I really, you know, took this one to heart and embedded it as an intrinsic motivation for me in that, you know, I've been made redundant this year. I have got significantly less money than I've ever had, you know, for probably in my working career, actually coming in. We've had to adapt our business, the coaching model, to a very different thing. I've had to think about, do I start new businesses? I've had to make that really significant decision of going, I'm just going to be self-employed now. Because actually, I think there comes to a certain point where you're self-employed for that long that you can't be employed again. And I've had to kind of come to terms with, I think that's where I'm at. I'm at this risk-taking thing. So for me, it was really about 2020. In a lot of ways, it's been a really, I'm not gonna sit here and go, in a lot of ways, it's been a shit year, but I'm not going to be like, oh, it's been a shit year, because that's not the kind of person I am. I actually found it to be a really good year in a lot of ways, certainly spending a lot more time at home and with my family and rediscovering things that I love. So it's a really...
I think it's very difficult to for lots of us to think of it as taking any kind of positives out of it. But if you do go look for them, I think they're there. The problem is, the difficulty is that everything that we consume media wise is bloody negative.
Yeah.
You know, so you just, and you end up having chats with your pals and your mates and stuff, and we're all sort of moaning about the same thing, and we don't want to talk about it anymore, but we can't help but talk about it.
And then when somebody is really positive, so like me and Sazzy doing this marathon, people are like, people, oh, look at them. Oh, look at, who does she think she is? Honestly, I let this drift over me. I am very careful about how much media I consume. If I listen to more than 5 minutes a day of news, that's a lot. I do listen to the news because I do think it's important to know what's going on. But I really limit myself. It's like in the morning and then that is it. The rest is podcasts that are positive. So from this challenge point of view, I really, you know, at the beginning of the year, I did set myself a goal. And back in January, I set myself 12 goals every year. And one of them was to run a really good half marathon and to run the Yorkshire Marathon, because I hadn't got into London. And obviously they'd all gone out the window in, you know, March, April, May. And I don't mind saying I probably spent most of April and May drunk. Talk about me not drinking for 10 days before doing this run, that is a long time for me not to have a drop of alcohol. I was definitely using alcohol as a way to moderate my anxiety. And I think that's okay for a small bit of time, but I very quickly realized that had to stop, because it was meaning I was foregoing my productivity and mental toughness. So I really wanted to take back that original goal that I'd said around doing the Yorkshire Marathon. Now, obviously, the Yorkshire Marathon isn't on, but I live in Yorkshire. So me and Saz have run the Yorkshire Marathon. And we planned out a really beautiful route round Doncaster, running, you know, like memories of childhood. Like, we didn't run the same path twice. You know, we ran up to the airport, through Bawtry, where I got married, back down Bawtry Road to all the houses that I would one day love to be able to afford, you know, like, it was just such a lovely run. So it was really about being driven to succeed for a goal that I thought was gone to me this year, because external events have changed this year, and actually saying, well, no, you could moderate the goal slightly, but the achievement will still be the same.
I'm just a bit curious, because you had other people joining you on the race, and Gareth, your husband, he did it on his bike.
Yeah, poor Gareth.
And then looked after you afterwards, and still having to look after you now, get you up and down the stairs. What I'm really interested in, did you stop at any point?
No.
And did you ever talk about, would you stop?
No.
Right.
To both of those. So we didn't stop at any bits, even when and this is the thing where a planned running route on an official event is brilliant, because there's no traffic, but to even have that mindset that if cars were coming, I just ran out into the road and was just like, stop, because I was in front of Sazzy the whole way, so she'd have a good run. And like, A roads and everything were just like, Gareth had run ahead, press all the traffic, but you know, he's on the bike, so he'd cycle, do all the traffic lights
legend
for us, legend. But at no point, I think at one point I said to Saz, are you all right? And she really slowed down about mile 18. So we all slowed down with her. But she never said she wanted to stop. and I didn't. And then I really hit the wall, like not wall, because I know mentally what a wall feels like, but my body really started to give up on me at about mile 23. I never thought I was going to stop. I was just like, Gareth was trying to talk to me at that point and make me feel better. And I'll not repeat on this what I said to him, but it was similar to what I said to him in labour. Bleep, 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 just F off. And he was like, I'm going to go home if you keep talking to me. We had a proper full-on domestic. I was like, how can this bloke who's been with me for this long not know that when I am in the zone, I just need you to not talk to me. I need you to fuck off. And instead he was like, do you need a drink, darling? Do you need a gel? And I was just like, get away from me.
And all he's trying to do, like all of us do, is help. He's just trying to be supportive.
The best husband ever. And I'm so lucky to have him. I don't appreciate him. I know I don't. So, but on that, about the support, you know, this is where I guess in leadership as well, you've got to know that you can't do everything. You've got to plan in your support. We had Gareth cycle beside us from mile 10. So for the last 16 miles, Gareth cycled. He had a little basket on the front of his mountain bike. He had all our gels pre-opened for us. He had Lucozade, he had water. He learned very quickly that every time we need a gel, I must have water instantly after, because he wasn't quite fast enough at first. Our friend Jamie joined us for the last 10 miles. So to get somebody who had really fresh legs to pace you after 10 miles was brilliant. Yeah. Our friend George joined us for the last 5 miles. What was really funny about George is she couldn't keep up. So she had to drop out and just cheer us on. So that was great. And then we had all our friends and family, you know, come along, and so grateful for all that support. And I think it'd be interesting, actually, what happens to the London Marathon. And is there a place for virtual marathons? Because when you've got the crowd, it's amazing. But actually, you don't know a lot of the crowd. Whereas, because we were running it in our hometown, I knew all the supporters. And yes, they were intermittent support, but it felt much more personal. And so I don't know. I think there might be something in this.
They could be. When I did the Great North, I didn't know any of the crowd.
Yeah.
I'm not from Newcastle. And there are so many people, so many competitors in that race anyway. But the thing about the Northeast is like wonderful people up there, and they all come out of the houses, and pretty much the route is lined all the way.
Yeah.
And I did find that really motivating, even though I didn't know them. So it will be interesting to see what would happen.
Different for other people,
I could easily see that, but
that
knowing people had made the effort to come out to see you, who knew you, would
I think
be motivational as well.
I think the support was nicer around, because it was people that had come out especially to see us, and my little boy, which I'll talk about in a bit. But you are right, actually. That last 2 miles, when the crowd are just thick and fast, I really missed that this time. And we were actually doing it on a bit where people were dog walking and just getting in our way and having to dodge people at the last bit because they were on their Sunday walk was really annoying.
Yeah.
But I do think that is interesting. But to bring that back to a leadership context around support, I think a lot of the time when you're doing a big project, as a leader, you think about the team and you think about keeping the same people on the team because they've got ownership of the project. But I am actually thinking back to mental toughness and having Jamie, our friend, join us for the last 10 miles. Actually, it can be invigorating if handled well and communicated well that somebody fresh joins an existing team halfway through as it's about to get difficult. And Jamie's really seasoned half marathon runner, way faster than us. So we had somebody with a different level of experience, you know, that like you look at Elliot Kipchoge, Mo Farah was his pacer. And going off on a slight tangent here, but I do think the reason men's marathon running times are so much faster than women's, obviously there's the physicalities, but they're quite a lot ahead in terms of how long men have been professionally running marathons than women. So I watched the women's race back on Sunday. When I watched the men's race, it felt like more of a team, you know, almost like cycling, where there was pacers and the Ethiopians ran together and the Kenyans ran together, and they ran very tight and they were like supporting each other. Now, you know, everybody's in their own race, but people that run with Elliot Kipchoge know that their mission is to make him be great. And to, now he didn't end up coming anywhere near.
They understand that.
the women's race still feels very solo. You watch it and the women aren't, they're not looking at each other in a friendly, supportive way. The little nudges aren't there. It's a very
solo activity. That,
and I wonder if it's just because women's running is 20 years behind men's, and there isn't the amount of them and the money isn't there to share it. Whereas you look at the people that support Elliot and who runs...
So
I think bringing this back to the leadership context is, what environment are you creating in your team? Are you creating one of, yes, there's a little bit of competitiveness around who wants to be the best one to deliver the project, but there really is a team and a team feeling of core purpose? Or is it more similar to the women's marathon event where everybody's out for themselves and it's just she that is first over the line? And I think you've got to really think about what support is there. And I think back to our marathon and mental toughness. You know, Gareth was almost like a mentor and a supplier, I guess. Yeah. And in an organisational context where he was just a side... You know, all the time he was asking, do you want me to be in front, behind? He had music playing for us. He'd done a brilliant playlist. He had the right nutrition and hydration. And I would really think about that in an organisational context of making sure your suppliers are as fit as you and they're up for the job and they've got the right equipment. And you obviously got a supplier that's on a bike, not on a running.
What a wonderful way of looking at it. It's that whole stakeholder management.
Yeah. And then again, fresh people coming to run bits of us that we knew would be tougher. Somebody that was a far better shorter distance running than us that really could pace as well. And did give the tough love where it was like, come on, ladies, you're not even blowing. But we needed to be told that because we have that kind of banter with him.
I
think if you put that into an organisational leadership point of view, it's don't ever think that your people don't need support because they're saying they're okay, because they don't always know.
Yeah.
And that's the leader's role, really.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation.
You know, my role in running that marathon was leader. Absolutely. I ran that to pace Sazzy and I was the leader until 18 miles. And at 18 miles, a good leader knows when they need to let somebody else lead. And that's when Jamie led. And then at the end, because it was Sazzy's race, I dropped right back and she ran ahead of me. I was the pacer, but I was like, no.
If you contrasted that with one of your first runs, when it was a little bit more about...
That was about me.
Your own achievement. As in, I need to win this. I need to lead it. Perhaps those that emotional sort of view that you took to consider these other people and consider what was best for the team wouldn't really have occurred to you then.
No, it wouldn't. And I'm just thinking back, like, the first marathon I ever run was absolutely to mend a broken heart. You know, I got into running because I was going out with this bloke. We'll call him Bob for the purposes of this podcast. Bob and I were properly, you know, that heartbreaking, passionate love when you're younger and, you know, the world's going to end when you split up. And you make really bad decisions when you think like this, actually, to be fair. And bad decisions are that you don't leave them when you should have left them and you go back to them when you shouldn't go back to them. Anyway, when he finally went to live in America and left me in Australia, the narrative would go, perhaps I was a bit of a dick in the relationship as well, but you know.
You might have been contributing to the problem.
I may have been contributing. I was more than contributing to the problem. I was massively part of the problem. But you can't, you never see these things when you're in them. Hindsight is a beautiful thing. But I got into running very much as a way to deal with that heartbreak. So running that first marathon was very much overcoming that. The second marathon was, I'd been heartbroken, but it was to show that I could have a life beyond him and a little bit of a two fingers up to him. In my head, you know, obviously he played no part in it. We weren't in touch then, I don't think. But it really was, a bit of a, like, Adele was my soundtrack for that entire year.
Oh,
God. God, like, I think the only reason I got so fast at running was because I was wailing and people used to
Gareth
stop me.
So Gareth knew not to play Adele on your soundtrack.
No Adele. Well, actually, if I hadn't have gone out with that guy, I would never have gone for a man as nice as Gareth. I think, again, you've got to think about the learnings. But we digress. But about this thing, it was a very much a solo activity, and it was about me and my ego and my need, but also it was about proving to external people. It wasn't intrinsic, whereas this marathon did feel more like a team effort, as leadership should. And I think this is where you see the difference between great leaders and just okay leaders or leaders and managers. Managers, it seems to be for that extrinsic, external recognition, or that my mum and dad always wanted me to do this, or I deserve this, or, you know, this mentality where it's me, me, me. Whereas when we look at really inspirational leaders and more seasoned leaders that have perhaps had a few knocks along the way and learned and been on a journey of self-awareness, and we see a lot of this when we're coaching people, yeah, is you kind of realise that it's not all about you, and that is the gift in itself, is it to be of service to somebody else. Mm. So to run this marathon for Sarah, really, with Sarah, but also for it to be about more than you. So one of the things when I was running that marathon that I ran very fast in, the Sydney one, when I was running around it, I was kind of, to make myself not miss my ex, I was visualising my life with somebody else and me having a little boy, and one day wouldn't it be great to have kids? Because I think when you split up with a partner, you don't just leave that partner and miss them, but you're like leaving the future that you imagined with them. And I thought I'd have kids with this person, I thought I'd get married to this person, and that wasn't to be. So I kind of visualised in my early 30s, you know, like maybe one day I'd run a marathon and I'd have a child and they'd be watching it. And in this marathon, you know, and I guess this is one of my leadership essentials that we'll do in a bit, is to really know your purpose. Now, part of my purpose was to support Sazzy, but that was only part of my purpose. That wouldn't have been strong enough. The big motivator for me was, number one, show myself I could achieve something this year. But also, it's very important for me now, as having a two-year-old boy, and particularly our focus on inclusivity and diversity, is that I want my little boy to grow up believing that women are as capable as men, and that women are as mentally as tough as men, and that women can do things that some men can't. And I want him to think, not that I'm competitive, that mummy's fitter than daddy. It's a little bit of extrinsic things with me. But you know, in my head, I thought this is a great opportunity to realise a goal and visualisation that I'd had for myself when I was 30. Yeah. You know, when I was heartbroken, I was so low. And I remember running this race and thinking, you know, one day I want this. And now I have it. And I thought, well, now I've got it, shouldn't I live my dream? And now, some people are probably thinking I'm mental, like your dream was to run a marathon and to have your son watch you. But it was. And you know, the first, my sisters drove him around and they stood and watched me. I think they cheered me on at about 4 points. And Felix is two, he didn't quite understand, but he understood the cheering, and that he was so excited. He was just going, my mummy, my mummy, my mummy. And to just hear that, and him just clapping and going, my mummy, my mummy.
And how motivational was that? Those 4 times.
Oh, honestly, the first time I saw him, Sazzy went to me, are you all right? She went, I'm crying. And I got all really teary, and I was like, I'm all right. That was like, for me, and I don't think there's many moments, you know, you have points in life where you visualize what you want your life to be. That for me was living like one of my visualized life's moments. Dreams,
special moment.
And a really special moment. And I think, you know, when we talk about purpose, you need to know your purpose 100%. And everybody will say this in leadership, you know, you've got to have a really clear purpose and things like that. What I think people don't really think about is it's an easy word to say, purpose, and to know your purpose, and organisations rally people around a core purpose. But as a leader, you've really got to think about what is your purpose. And it might be for your children, it might be to give something back. But then if it is for your kids, you've got to really think about how I am acting day in, day out, how I am being at work, how I am as a leader. It's all right saying I'm doing this for my children so they have a better life. But what are you role modelling for your children? Because if your children are your purpose, but you're still working 14 hours a day, really? Is there something a bit amiss here where you're working 14 hours a day because your kids are your purpose, because you want them to have more than what you've ever had, but you're robbing your child of the one thing that they want more than anything, which is your time?
Yeah.
And I think this is where we've really got to look at the value hierarchy and the purpose hierarchy. And purpose is a really easy word to bland around. And if I'm honest, it's the thing that I probably struggle with most as a parent, is absolutely my child is a really big purpose for me. He's not my sole purpose, though, because I have things I want to do just for me. But when I think about him and why I'm doing things, you know, it was really important for me that he saw me running, that I was role modelling to him. I love it, you know, when I go out in the morning and I run with the dog, that he sees me in my athletic gear, that he sees that mummy is strong and she just goes and she puts her running first. And I put my running first before even getting him dressed, because I need to feed myself first, sure, to look after him.
Yeah.
But I also, back to the purpose thing, I think sometimes when I'm short-tempered or when I'm swearing or when I'm not being my best self, which you've never seen, have you, John? But but I think at those moments, they're a lot fewer than they used to be, because I have to think about, and I have to remind myself of this constantly, is how I am acting in a leadership context, in a business context, in a personal context, a way that my son will be proud of. Because it's all right to say I'm doing it for him. It's all right to say I'm going to go out and win a £10,000 piece of work. But if the way I'm getting that work is not aligned with my values, or the way I'm behaving when I've got that work is not a way that my son is going to be proud of me or a role model to my son, I don't want to be doing it. And if it means that, yeah, it's however much money and it's more money than I've ever had before, but it's going to take me away from him for 20 days, is that really aligned with him being my purpose? And so I think if you're still listening to us at this point, it is really, we all tend to know our purpose, and you can usually say it's something to do with wife, kids, giving something back, a bigger sense of purpose. But look at it in line with your values. And are you living it? It's very hard to live day to day, week to week, hour to hour, but it's about reminding yourself of that.
What they are, for sure.
And literally, I have to be so careful with the phone, how often I look at the phone and when I'm with the phone. But again, I do meditation and yoga every morning. Through all of lockdown, I've been doing yoga every day. And I've been making sure Felix sees me do it. Now, it's a little bit annoying when your kid's trying to do downward dog on you while you're doing downward dog. But actually, I do that on purpose, because I want him to think that yoga is something you do.
So that has been so insightful, Rachel. Really has. A lot of insightful thinking. We ran through a couple of models, which we, as I say, we'll share with you in the notes. When you look back across not just the race, but let's say the 2 weeks preceding that, when your friend asked you to run with her, what are your three leadership essentials that come from all of that?
And I think this is the thing about it, because they are leadership essentials, because I've just borrowed what I've known from a leadership context and applied it to running a marathon. The first one is just what I was talking about, is number one, have a really clear purpose. And for me, the purpose for running 16 miles was totally in service of somebody else. And I really think the older I get, the more I think about doing things in service of others. But running the whole thing and that sense of achievement 100% was for my son. And it was really important for me to live that moment after such a shit year. But a shit year with some good points. He saw me, and I saw myself living an early visualization that I'd had 8 years ago. So that's leadership essential number one, is really get clear on your purpose in work, but then make sure and revisit your purpose that it aligns with your values and how you live in your work, you live in your life and the way you work. Number two is really about looking into mental toughness. And again, it's not, we tend to know the psychology of it and we tend to know the bits around it, but actually spending some time that as a leader, you aren't what you do. You are, it's how you're showing up. It's how you're being.
Is that the breakdown of mental toughness? Like its constituent parts?
Read up on the subject of mental toughness if you are interested, because there's the sports side and there's so much writing on that. There's Clough's model around the control, commitment, confidence and challenge. There's the the MTQ 48 study of it. There's the research around, you know, if you are higher in mental toughness, you are going to be a better leader and you've got higher incidence of that. But it really is about, at its essence, right, it's about having an awareness of when you're at your peak performance, and it's when you're rested, when you've had good sleep, when you're looking at what you put into your body. My mental toughness has gone up massively since I've stopped eating meat. But again, that's, I've noticed that in myself since I've started meditation, since I can take control of how I'm feeling and my emotions, how I exercise, my goal setting, all these things. And people say, oh, but I'm not that kind of person, or I'm not a gritty individual. You can measure yourself on these things. There are free tools online. And you can do things to increase your mental toughness and your level of grit. And mindfulness is one of them, and being more aware. You can, these things aren't static. So I think...
So that's your second
That is my second one.
Essential.
Is to really think about your own mental toughness and how you can increase it. But you've got to link it to a leadership essential number one, and you've got to have a reason for wanting to increase it. You know, if you really can say you're the best leader you want to be now, then that's great. But do you want to be better? That's not everybody does, do they?
No,
so
no.
So therein lies the thing. And then my third leadership essential, again, we've talked about this, is just making sure you've got the support around you. And this is something I definitely underestimated or didn't think I needed, you know, as the young, naive and arrogant don't. And, you know, I do joke, if I could just revisit myself in my 30s, early 30s, just be like, oh, dear Lord. But how arrogant you are sometimes, that you don't need people's help, or you see people's help as them trying to take over a project. And actually, what leadership is about knowing the role of support, understanding the role of support, realizing when you're a support to others, when you need support as a leader, planning in your support, using your suppliers as a form of support, using your loved ones as a form of support, getting experts in to support you, and then almost looking at leadership that's something that can be interchanged at certain points in that race. 18 miles where I felt myself fatigue was, right, well, am I actually the best leader at this moment for this team? No, I'm not. It's time for somebody else to go ahead. And again, thinking about that in a leadership context, and thinking about, when do you give somebody else the reins so you can recuperate, and that rest is, knowing when to rest is actually a leadership trait in itself. So that would be it. They're my leadership essentials. For those of you that are interested, we ran the marathon in 4:07, which is nowhere near a PB for me. But gosh, I was just, if we'd have been over 4:30, I would have been disappointed. So I was just so pleased with myself. I thoroughly enjoyed all but 2 miles of it. It's got to see Doncaster in such a different light. Mm-hmm. And the support after, we all went to the pub, had socially distanced drinks and different tables of our group of six, had a shandy, treating myself to a shandy, loads of sweets. I just feel bloody brilliant for doing it.
Brilliant,
yeah,
brilliant.
I really, really enjoyed it.
So many wonderful, wonderful things in there. So many insightful thoughts. I've thoroughly enjoyed listening to you telling that story. And I think there are so many parallels that you can take from it and put into, you know, leadership situations at work and also in your own personal life. You know, just setting those goals and being able to tick a few of them off. But it's this, what I really liked about it is this idea of how we learn and how much we grow and actually how much enjoyment we get out of tackling something as big as that, for a lot of different reasons that are not just about ego, not just about winning, that they actually feed you as an individual.
I'm really glad you've explained it like that, because I just, you know, it's very difficult to remain positive at this time, and a lot of things have been taken out of our control.
Yeah.
And what I really love about long distance running, and I spoke to another friend who's a trail runner, is that actually find something, anything that you can get better at as you get older. It's like, it's not this feeling of like I'm approaching my 40s of feeling like things have
that's
gone
it now.
That's it now. It's actually like, well, I'm actually thinking now I could be the best marathon runner I've ever been in my 40s. I've already entered like two for next year already. But again, with like I've started trail running a bit because it's a different challenge. I know you play a lot of golf, but don't be thinking, oh, but this is just me and I've done it. For me, it's about saying, well, what can you control? What can you get better at? I think leadership is something you absolutely get better at with age and experience. Maybe not in Donald Trump's case, but...
There's always the exception to the rule.
But yeah, things aren't static and that it's yours for the taking and that it's about, yeah, just seeing things differently. So I can't wait for us to be doing this podcast next year when you've done it, John.
Well, you never know. I mean, you said that people get better in the 30s and the 40s. And I was going to ask you, like, do you think that is, like, possible in your 50s?
There was a guy running it. It was 83.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that's actually stopped me from doing it is just the impact on my knees. You know, I know I can run on a treadmill, and that's fine. I get a little bit of that sort of a cushioned effect, but that is the only thing that would probably stop me. But yeah, there's the challenge.
So I hope you've enjoyed that bit of a different one for this week, but you know, the London Marathon, it was its 40th year. It was an incredible experience to be part of it. Next week we will be back to our usual format, won't we, John? So shorter next week, and leadership essentials and the coaching approach.
Yeah, so that's it for this week. Thank you very much, Rachel. Thoroughly enjoyed that.
I will be rested that next week.
Yeah, long wind
down. Yeah, thank you guys for listening.
See you again.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.